we need to look at those things. We will be releasing the new roadmap at ProMat next year. So just be aware of that. It will be released at ProMat of next year. And we went out to all five stakeholders. So we have touched academic, the end user, the supplier, government, and the trade association. So very comprehensive report and background. So I'm really excited to get the conference kicked off with the roadmap. You're in for a treat throughout the conference. We have a lot going on. Please, if you haven't already, download the app. We do have an app with everything going on, MHI Annual Conference, that you'll be able to get all the information for what's happening for the next 3 days. So with that, I want to say once again, welcome. I want to turn it over now to your moderator for the roadmap panel, Dan Gilmore, the president and publisher of Supply Chain Digest. Let's welcome Dan.
All right, thanks everybody. Appreciate you coming out here. Looking forward to a good discussion. As Ralph indicated here, we're talking about, you know, I did a panel here on the roadmap in 2015 at MHI, which where we're in Jacksonville, something like that. And in that time, we were looking at, after the roadmap had come out in when, Gary, 2014? Yes, 2014. So last year, in a similar kind of panel discussion, in a sense, we looked at the original roadmap and said, how are companies and organizations actually using the content or the thinking in the roadmap to adjust their own strategies and whatnot. So we had a nice panel. We had one holdover, which I'll get to in a second. Jonathan Rader from FedEx was on that panel. Everyone else is new this year. So this year, along the themes that Ralph just talked about there that are kind of guiding the initial data collection and analysis for this upcoming roadmap that's going to be released at, in 2017, we're going to discuss some of the key issues around those four topics. And those are, again, workforce, technology, consumer infrastructure, pretty broad topics. And then we're adding a couple more that kind of come in there, if we have time, around supply chain innovation and ROI and value from your investments in materials handling and related technology. So this is pretty broad topics, as you just can gather there when you talk about technology. Boy, that's a big topic. They have a whole panel on technology. Infrastructure, that's a big topic, et cetera, et cetera. So it's been a lot of effort to pull this together. One of the things that is clear is that nobody, including me, knows a lot about everything, but I can guarantee you that our panelists all know a lot about something, and so we've spent a lot of time, I've interrogated them heavily over the last 6 to 8 weeks about who knows what, so we've kind of organized it along those four or five different dimensions that I talked about, and some people know something about something, and they'll add to the conversation. Other people will add to other things. So one of the reasons I bring that up is I think having audience participation here will wind up being key, okay? Because this is almost, Gary, like another one of these mini enclaves. We'd like to get some conclaves. We'd like to get some feedback from the audience about some of these topics to supplement what our panelists have to say. So I guess what we're doing. So our panelists, go through the order on the screen, we have Gary Forger, who's a consultant with MHI. He's down there at the far end. Of course, for many years was editor of Modern Materials Handling, where I first got to know him. We have Mike Kotecki, who's with Thematic, part of that HK Systems, maybe soon to be. What's the name of that German company?
Keon.
Keon. So I'm not sure where that is exactly, but anyway, there's a deal coming down. But I've known Mike for many years, and he's incredibly knowledgeable about a number of logistics topics. Bill Farrell, who is at Clemson University. Bill, raise your hand. And then you also, refresh our memory, that acronym there, the CICMHE, that's kind of an academic organization. What is that again? What does that do?
It's the College Industry Council on Material Handling Education, which is a group within MHI that has been around since 1954. Long-standing, we are one of you and a little bit different. So we have 1 foot in academia, 1 foot in practice, and enjoy working with you as well as our college and academia for to provide opportunities to students, to teachers of material handling education, to researchers, and to you industry members.
Okay, very good. And again, Jonathan Rader with FedEx. And we have Mike Regan with Transact Technologies, an expert in all things transportation and trucking related. I've gotten to know Mike very well over the last few years. And Pat Braska, lastly, from JDA Software. And I'm cutting him a little bit short by calling him Fab Braska. So just for the morning's get things off, Fab, your real name would be?
Fabrizio Dino Marcello.
There you go. Okay. Congratulations. I've seen Fab do that himself in a couple times. But I think we'll stick with Fab. All right, very good. So we're going to kick things off here. The way it's going to work is for each of these topics, the first time we go through them, workforce, et cetera, I'm going to do just a little introductory chart or two to just sort of kick things off. Then I'm going to ask Gary to provide some highlights from the discussions of the first, is it two or three of these conclaves that you've done?
Yeah, first couple.
First couple, okay. So again, there's a meeting of 40, 50, I don't know, I did it last time, I'm not sure this year how many they're getting, but these people come in and spend a day and a half or something like that talking through all of these topics, and Gary has been scribing and summarized some of the key findings. So I'm going to have him do that, and then we'll get into the panel. So where am I going with this? Okay, yeah, so a couple things on workforce, you know. It has several dimensions. So you hear this thing out there about the talent crisis. I'm sure most of you have heard that term in supply chain. I think there is an issue. I don't know if it's a crisis. But, and that implies to me sort of a managerial talent type of aspect to it. There's also a more blue-collar aspect of it, which is our workforce is getting older and aging, and some manufacturers and trucking, we're going to get into that in a second. I have a hard time finding workers. There may be some other dimensions to it. So this workforce issue is a big one, and to me, and I've done some writing about this, I'm going to do some more, it's also very much tied into demographics. So I have a new set of 10 megatrends coming up, and one of them is going to be demographics, because you look at what's going on here, it's maybe a little bit hard to see, and the panel can't see it, unfortunately, but this shows the percentage of, or the different countries highlighted in different blues, of the percent of a population that's going to be over 65 in 2015 versus the projections for 2050, and you can't see it. But the number more than 25%, in some cases even more than 28%, by 2050 is going to be 25-30% of the population. This is going to have dramatic impacts on virtually everything. Obviously, you hold the whole social network and how do fewer workers support so many older people. Maybe robotics winds up being some of the answer. Obviously, the cost of the healthcare system and all these other kind of things. So this is a pretty eye-opening chart. In terms of where we're heading with demographics. One of the interesting things I didn't realize was this McKinsey, I think, did this. McKinsey did an analysis and showed that a slowing population growth is a tremendous driver of actually what happens with global or given economies' GDP. And so as population growth is shrinking everywhere in the world, with the exception of some areas of Africa right now, even many areas of Asia that people thought was going to be tremendous population growth for years is slowing dramatically now. So you see that they're projecting that the global economic growth that they have 3.8% annually from 1950 to 2014 is going to slow to 2.1% over the next few decades. And again, that primarily the result of slowing population growth. That's kind of an eye-opener for me. Productivity has been going down of late, and that's another factor in here. You have fewer workers, the productivity is slowing down. That's a big impact on GDP growth and standard of living. And I'd just throw up this real quick. BMW 4 or 5 years ago was seeing the same kind of demographic trend I talked about a second ago impacting their manufacturing workers. And they realized that cohort of older folks was going to be the main people on the floor going forward. So they, there's a longer list of stuff here, but what you can't see is BMW implemented a number of changes on the manufacturing floor at little tiny investments for the most part, 5,000 euros here, 1,000 euros there, whatever, and had a dramatic impact on productivity and worker retention. So I think these are the kind of things that we're going to need to be looking at in order to cope with these changing demographics. So that's kind of opening remarks from me. Gary, comments from or themes or trends, what have you seen at the first couple of workshops in terms of this issue of workforce?
Okay, and you have to understand that I've condensed this. It is purely highlights, and it's just some of the points that are going to be discussed here. So it really works under the umbrella of find, train, retain. And I've asked at each of them the question, which of the three is the most important? And there's no consensus. It changes with the group. So let's just try it here for a minute. Find, train, retain. Who thinks find is most important and difficult today? Okay. How about train? About the same. And retain is everybody else. Wow. Okay. That mirrors what happened in Atlanta, just so you know. For fine, it's really one of the things that has come out of this is industry and education organizations have to start to work more closely together. We had somebody in Atlanta say, in particular, that they're very concerned about what's coming out of the universities today, because the people who are teaching have not been in industry and designing warehouses in the past 5 years. So you can see how compressed this has become and how high the expectations are for out there. The other expectation that's out there is, in many cases, my new hire is ready to go on day one. I'm not going to have to do much to get them going. And honestly, I think that's more of an aspiration than anything else. Because by the time you get to train, you're seeing that that attitude is starting to shift. And there's a new paradigm that's starting to come out of this, where they look at training as being 10% formal classes. And then they look at mentors and coaches as being 20%. And then the one that takes most time is actually on-the-job training, which takes 70% of the time. So you can see the attitudes and expectations are changing a little bit here. In terms of retaining, loyalty is an issue on both sides. We've all heard the phrase about the millennials, they're going to have 22-year careers, and you also look at layoffs, and you say, how does this work? That in itself says the culture needs to change here, and it goes beyond just loyalty, because it involves also making the job more attractive, making the company be innovative, and getting rid of stagnation. So there are high expectations, both internally and from people coming in on that. There's also going to probably have to be an attitude and adjustment towards wages. From what I hear from consultants going out there, $12.50 an hour at a warehouse, who would want anything more than that? And the fact of the matter is, they'll jump for 25 cents. That is not the target. So while, again, that might be aspirational today, that needs to change. I think what we're hearing is fundamentally work is going to change over the next 10 years. We were in Trenton, and they were having trouble with this question. I asked somebody who was in his 20s, do you think you're going to be working the same way 10 years from now as you are today? He said, no, why would I think that? So how it's going to change, we still have to figure out. Is it going to be automation? Is it going to be a different approach? That kind of thing. They also say that workforce issues in the next 10 years will not be resolved. They may change, they may evolve, but they won't be resolved. Something else will come into effect here. And I think something we have to keep in mind as a final point here is when you look at supply chain, it's a relatively new profession. You can only go back 30 years that you really say supply chain existed per se. The fact of the matter is attorneys, accountants, all the rest have been around for a long time, and it's fairly well understood what they do, how they go about it, and how it's going to work. Supply chain is still trying to figure out how all that's going to work. Yeah.
Very good. So again, great comments, Gary. And again, I'd say kind of highlights the multi-dimensions of this issue. There's a white-collar aspect. There's a blue-collar aspect. Just a couple of quick anecdotes before I get some panel feedback. But I was at a recent presentation by a guy named Steve Nunzio from Ohio State. They're in Columbus, of course, not far from me. Got a couple of Buckeyes in the family. He said that right now, you know, Columbus, of course, major distribution center hub. And he said, depending on the time of the year, that the amount of DC workers needed in Columbus is anywhere from 20 to 30,000. But Amazon, and it's tight, very tight, been tight for several years, Amazon is coming in and opening two new facilities that are going to require 3,000 more in the general Columbus area. And he's already seeing postings for $18.50 an hour for warehouse labor in that Columbus area. So that's one thing. Second, probably many of you have heard of a company called Stryker, which is a very large medical devices company headquartered somewhere up in Michigan. Saw their VP of Supply Chain presented at the University of Tennessee conference earlier this year. He was almost begging students in attendance at this event to send him resumes. They can't get the people, they can't find the people to come and be part of that very excellent supply chain. So just a couple of things. So very good. So Jonathan, obviously FedEx has lots of employees, blue and white collar. I have mixed emotions sometimes about, you know, is this talent crisis overhyped? I know it's an issue, maybe a little bit overhyped. Your thoughts are, is this talent crisis real?
Absolutely real. I mean, we're seeing it today. I mean, it's not something that's coming. It's happening right now. You read about it in nearly every trade publication that's out there about there's a challenge with finding the talent and retaining the talent. But, you know, those things both go together. While the population growth is slowing, it's not gone. There's still people out there. So it really seems like it's a matter of the folks just don't want to work in this industry. So it's about attracting them and keeping them there and making it someplace that they want to stay. That's what we have to focus on.
And you're talking in that perspective from a DC associate type worker. Is that what you're talking about, or are you talking about white collar also?
Well, really, I think it's across the spectrum.
Okay.
And I know we'll talk a little bit more later about this, but I think all those things are interrelated. The immediate need right now is in the DC type things, but that grows, right? Because those are your people that promote into higher levels of the organization. So while we're seeing the problem in one layer right now, we're going to see it higher up the chain in the not too distant future.
Yeah, very good. How are you? Is FedEx reacting to that? What are you doing in terms of changing compensation, recruiting, searching, whatever? What kind of an impact is this having on what you're doing?
Well, we need to change our mode of thinking, and I don't know that we necessarily have our arms around completely right now. But I mean, there's a lot of people working on that question. Changing the perception of the workplace is a big part, or of the industry. And it's not just about pay, although we know that people are jumping for relatively small changes in pay, but that's not the whole thing. You know, it's a very cutthroat industry to try to keep those people here versus going one place to the other, but we've got to change the work environment. We've got to make it some place that people want to stay in, where they want to be. We've got to change the attitudes of the company, the culture that they work in, show that there's opportunity. These are all factors that are going to go into the soup.
Are we, in a sense, maybe perhaps fooling ourselves a little bit, positioning that a job as a DC associate is, in fact, a good job when maybe it is not?
That's a good question. I guess if you want to look at the here and now versus what your potential is down the road, and it's about growth, and that's where the retention aspect comes in. One thing it isn't, though, I don't think that jobs in the distribution chain or in supply chain, I don't know that we can think of them as industrial jobs anymore. They're not. That it's evolving to such that it's not just an industrial environment, and we need to change everything that goes into that.
Yeah. It's amazing. I haven't been to many lately, but over the last, I mean, I've been to, like many of you, into many, many DCs, and it's interesting to me. You can, as I'm walking around maybe with the VP of logistics or something, it's amazing the difference you can just sense walking around. The one VP knows everyone's name, and says, "Hey, how you doing?" and talks for a second and whatever, and the others, you know, walk past them like, you know, they don't exist or whatever. And you can get that sense very quickly as how engaged management is with the workers, it seems to me. And I think on the end, that's got to have something of an impact, although will they still jump for 25 cents an hour or not, I don't know. How about anybody from the audience out there? Are you there on the blue-collar side, warehouse, a DC side, manufacturing floor, or on the, you know, the managerial side? You know, do you think this talent crisis, this worker shortage is real? A little bit overblown? Depends on the area. Anybody's thoughts? Anybody out there have any comments or input that might add? There'd be somebody out there. Yes, sir.
And I walk DCs every week, customers, prospects, et cetera, and I agree with the message here. What I hear consistently is anywhere from 35 to 65% turnover rates in DCs, depending on geography. And what's worse is on the fine side, I hear numbers of anywhere 6 to 8 temp workers to find one good hire out of that pool. Those are consistent numbers that I hear week after week after week.
Yeah. See a lot of people shaking their heads yes out there, same kind of thing you're seeing or experiencing? Yeah? Okay. Yeah.
We're seeing in some regions where they're busing temporary workers in from 100, 150 miles away just to make it through their peaks. Northern Kentucky, Cincinnati area, Columbus area. I mean, so yes, I think it's very real.
Yeah, I mean the Columbus, Cincinnati, all the Dallas, whatever, all the major hub, DC hub type of regions seem to be just really struggling right now. It's actually going to be interesting because I'm going to tie this back to some of the trucking issues I'm going to talk about with Mike here in a second because, you know, up to 1850 or whatever now it is in Columbus, is that heading higher? And why isn't the market wage rising enough to clear the, you know, I mean, I think I'm just making something up. At $30 an hour, I think you probably get lots of applicants, okay? That's a lot of money. But nevertheless, so we have that DC shortage of workers, particularly in key distribution-oriented markets of the country. We've been talking about the driver shortage, the truck driver shortage for many years now. And I'm in the same kind of way. It's an issue. Sometimes maybe I think a little bit overblown. I kind of vacillate back and forth on this. Mike Garrigan's been talking and thinking about this for many, many years. And Mike, you and I have talked about it offline and online. Your thoughts, how significant is this truck driver shortage?
It's as significant and then some as you could possibly imagine. According to the American Trucking Association, within 2 years, we will have a shortage of about 300,000 truck drivers. It varies among the LTL carriers and the truckload carriers. I serve on the board of a publicly traded truckload carrier. Retention for truck drivers, for truckload carriers, if you're under 90%, you're doing well. Think about that. 90%. Now, the key is, what skews that, is what happens in the first 12 months of when a driver comes on board. If you can retain that driver past the 12 months, then the numbers start going down. The situation will get worse. Dan, you've been at the forefront of really highlighting this. You've got things coming out in the industry that by the end of 2017, the electronic logging devices are mandatory. Now, a group called the Owner-Operator Independent Driver Associations, which represents 4,000 trucking companies and is absolutely vital to your supply chain, has been in court fighting that. Based on the reports that we're getting from the court hearing, we don't think they're going to be successful. But here's practicality of what that means for drivers. Schneider Trucking, which is one of the best trucking companies in the business, when they went to ELDs, they lost approximately 5% productivity. That's Schneider. No one knows how much capacity is running illegally. Why is that illegal capacity important? Because when you're a driver and you're making 60, 70, 80 cents a mile as an owner-operator, and I now take your... I'll cut right to the chase. You can reduce your compensation under the ELD model by 8 to 10%. What's that going to do to the truck driving population? And so, you know, when you see Walmart, I was at a presentation a year and a half ago, Walmart is advertising for their fleet at $77,000 a year. And this is almost 2 years ago, with a lifestyle that is eminently more conducive than a truckload carrier, and they're still having spots. A friend of mine owns a trucking company, wanted to hire 30 drivers, put out applications, got 4,400 responses. From 4,400 responses, he got down to 300 that they could interview. You know, people sending in resumes without driver's license and this type of thing. Cutting right to the chase, he was able from that pool, after clearing through the FMCSA database, etc., he was able to offer jobs to two drivers. So when we're talking about the truck driver shortage, it is that bad and then some. And one story there?
Yeah.
Ron Johnson, the senator from Wisconsin, was instrumental in highlighting a program where for Sheboygan, how many of you are familiar with northern Wisconsin, the eastern side of Wisconsin, he was getting inner city represented kids and adults, busing them up to Manitowoc, Sheboygan, Kohler, just to find jobs, because there are a ton of jobs available in like the eastern Wisconsin with no one to fill them. It's been a tremendously successful program, but it highlights the extent to which companies are willing to do to get the workforce that they need to run their business.
Very good, Mike. So I agree with everything you said there. My reaction is couple-fold, though. In normal markets, and similar in a sense to what we just talked about a second ago on the VC side, you know, wages rise to the point where the supply comes back up. Now, you and I were at a session, I think 3 years ago at NASTRAC. Mike and I were in the same session, and I believe it was somebody from Warner was presenting and talked about what was needed from a pay perspective to get more drivers into the industry. And I don't remember who the company was, but if you remember, Mike, there was and then we walked through the implications of that. If the market clearing wage went up to whatever it was, up 50% or something, you know, what would that do to transport costs? And one shipper went to the microphone and said, we're not going to pay. We're not going to pay that. So you know, you're going to have to, I don't know what the answer was. So, Mike, over the last 18, 24 months, we've seen Swift, a number of other carriers, hike rates fairly substantially, 18, 20%, I think, somewhere in that range. Is that working? Does it need to go higher?
Actually, Derek Leathers, who runs Warner, is outstanding, and it needs to go higher. And for those of you that say, I won't pay it, simply go to the fourth quarter of 2013 and the first two quarters of 2014. when you couldn't find a truck. You need to move product? Here's my thesis. You will pay what it takes to move product instead of sitting in front of your CEO and explaining why you couldn't find a truck to satisfy a customer's order. And to give you an idea how bad it was in the first quarter of 2014, Derek Leathers, the president of Werner, when he walked into his office every morning, he had 145% of his capacity committed for the day. 145%. And you say, well, he only has 100% capacity. That's why all the trucking companies are going to asset-light groups. Asset-light being brokers. And so to kind of give you an idea, the market demand index went up. It's not something that you follow, but it's something that we in the industry follow. It was at 23.24 in the first quarter of 2014, and your rates in the spot markets were approximately 18 to 20% higher, and that representative at the NASDAQ meeting, trust me, he's either going to find trucks to move it, or he's going to find a job because he's not going to have one.
Mike, it seems to me that what's happened over the last few years is just every time it's about to break to that disaster-type scenario, we get some softness in the freight market, we get some softness in the economy, and it sort of ameliorates things a little bit. One of these times, we're actually going to get the strong economic growth in combination with those trends, and that's when it's really going to hit the fan.
So, in line, you're going to hear from a great economist as part of this presentation. It's my thesis that the economy has been significantly weaker than anyone's willing to talk about, because you see it in the freight market, okay? And, you know, like I said, I sit on the board of this trucking company and we track it. To Dan's point, we've said if the GDP ever got to 2.5%, you'd see a crisis. If it got anywhere approaching 3%, you'd see the motherlode of all trucking capacity. I will tell you, because Dan's also done a great job of following this, the carriers are not building capacity. So the number that we think would trigger a capacity where it would be a very strong seller's market is just north of 2% GDP. And as we all know, our GDP for the last couple of quarters has been anemic at best.
Yeah. Very good. Any other comments out there? You've seen it in the truck drivers as well. Yes, sir.
So I just want to ask a question. In your opinions, so obviously supply chain management we've covered very new the last 30 years, but this I'll call it trades. The inability to find good people for trade positions, trucking, mechanics, electrical, whatever that is, How much do you feel that is society-driven? We put such an emphasis on everybody on college, professors, that these positions are no longer glamorized. They're not talked about. In education, they're telling kids that there's kids that shouldn't go to college, you know, but they're pushing them to college, which even takes them down even further. So how do we change that part of it?
I will simply tell you, I could not agree more with, I think, your point, and that is the stigmatization of the roles and responsibilities. Here's a short little poll. Dan knows because I've done this in some of the audiences. Got a lot of smart people in there. How many of you know one person? Okay, we won't set the bar too high. Not four or five. Just one person that has said, you know what I want to do? I want to be a truck driver. Yet, a caddy at my golf course, wonderful kid, caddies for 7 years, comes out of school. He's going to have about $100,000 degree debt. He's a communications major. We say in Mexico, buena suerte, vaya con Dios. Kid can't find a job to save his neck. How many communications majors do you need? But we need truck drivers. And it is a job that, you know, if we make the right kind of changes, can be, you know, you can make 75, 80,000. Right now the base median we think is about 58, 60. And, you know, you're abused and disrespected. Who wants that job? Not one person in this room knows one person that wants to be a truck driver. Think about what that means.
I can't remember the study, but we reported on it maybe about a year ago. There was one recent study of drivers, and it was amazing, you know, the abuse that they still felt they took from being treated like they almost didn't exist to tremendous, you know, the waiting times and all that. You know, from shippers, and that was as big a frustration for them as the pay issue.
So the Food Shippers Association does a great job. Is anyone here work for grocery products companies? Good. I can be honest. They have taken abuse at the warehouse and magnified it to perfection level. I don't know how you could possibly be more abusive. But, you know, we were talking about that with the chargebacks and this type of thing. So a truck driver shows in, and they don't get, somebody's talking about a VP walking around and knows the names. That's not the world. But fortunately, there are the enlightened shippers, which are saying, we want to basically treat the driver with respect because it makes a difference in the quality of the service that we receive to make our company successful.
Unbelievable. Okay, I think with that, we're going to move on. Good to say, yes, sir, one comment quick.
Hey, Mike, what's the cost of a CDL now?
You know what? I honestly don't know the number right now. I apologize.
But are the companies are they paid for that?
Yeah. So right now the driver training programs at not a lot of companies, but people like Werner and some of the others, they're paying for you to get your CDL, go to driver training school, and for giving that over a period of time. So basically, you know, something that the millennials are seeing with college thing. The longer you stay with our organization, the less debt you'll have. So there are those trucking companies that are doing that.
Yep.
You're very blunt with the perspective. Where's driverless in your view?
Yeah. Well, you probably don't. FedEx and others may have. I don't see that happening within the next 3 to 5. It will happen in confined areas. I was at the Port of Jacksonville where we were getting a tour from the CEO, and where you're in a confined space, defined areas, and that type of stuff, no problem. You want a driverless, and even the driverless trucks will have somebody in the cab. So it's, you know, we have this thing called snow in Chicago, Gary, Indiana. You want a truck driving across I-80 with a 40-mile-an-hour wind and a blinding blade, and no problem. I got this under control. Yeah.
That'd be interesting to see. I think you may see plant tuning at some point, but completely autonomous, not so sure about that. Okay, I think we're going to move on to things going here. So the next area is technology. There's a nice narrow topic. We're talking about technology, but all kinds of stuff. And Fab, you can't see this, but we actually, it's Flushing Digest and JDA actually did a survey, May-ish or something like that, that came out that listed a whole bunch of sort of new age technologies and said, you know, where do you sort of rank the importance? And we're talking about everything here from, you know, Internet of Things, RFID, 3D printing, you know, big data, advanced analytics. I'm a big believer of advanced analytics. All kinds of things. So you see here, kind of, I think, you know, companies had to pick their top three. Supply chain visibility. You could debate whether that's new age or not, but nevertheless, it came in the top. Never enough visibility. Advanced analytics came in second at 52% of the audience in the top three. Better integration with trading partners, 44%. You kind of see on the list down here. So just to give a sense of where this is at, I think this number about augmented reality, 1%, I think that's an artificially low number. There's actually quite a bit happening with that in the distribution centers. If anybody's seen some of the research that various companies are doing here, or provides a way to create like virtual put walls and things like that, just looking through the glasses. So it could be very, very cool. So just a little data point. Gary, let's go back to you again from the conclaves. What's been the feedback around this big topic of supply chain technology?
Here's a phrase that came up in Atlanta and the breakout session wanted to trademark it. They said technology is the oxygen of the supply chain, and that's because it allows complex business-to-business and business-to-consumer relationships. So there's a point there. Now, I'm going to go through a list here of what needs to be affected by technology going forward, and as you can see, it's going to ramp up pretty quickly. In fact, they're looking for an order of magnitude improvement in the use of technology to lower costs, raise efficiencies, increase velocity, enable innovation, and change paradigms rapidly. So we're pretty quick there. So there are pretty high expectations for technology without identifying specific ones, because what we aren't doing in the roadmap is picking winners and losers. That's not what this is about. They're also looking for technology to become learning systems that will change as the business changes. There was also one other thought. Sorry about this, Mike. But they now want to go pretty much to the GE aircraft engine approach, where nobody sells equipment anymore. Instead, it's leased. So they're looking for 5-year leases for all material handling equipment in warehouses and manufacturing centers that will then be able to change out as the business changes going forward. There's also has to be a really tight link between technology and information systems. And where they got to was saying, ultimately, those with the closest link will be the winners going forward. Now, what are the barriers to technology going forward? One, of course, is workforce, legacy systems, cybersecurity, and the regulatory pace mismatch. Now, it's interesting because it plays off both ways. On the one hand, many are saying, too many regulations, we've got to reduce them. On the other hand, they say, we aren't keeping up well enough to be able to serve what needs to be done. in the end, what they're trying to do is create a win-win collaboration between all these components, with technology being at the center of it, so that everything works in a better way and is able to streamline the supply chain. I'm going to ask, just before I hand it off here, to do one last poll. I want to take the workforce that we just talked about and technology that we're talking about here. Right now, today, would you say that technology and the workforce, in terms of match, are below par, it's a sustainable match, or it's ahead of the curve? So below par, sustainable, or ahead of the curve? Who says it's below par? Okay, so probably about 40%. How about sustainable? Okay, 5%. Ahead of the curve. Hold up, we're not adding up here. Who didn't raise their hand? So going forward 10 years, will it be below par, sustainable, or ahead of the curve? Below par. Okay, probably about 25%. Sustainable?
At least, yeah. More than that.
Okay, probably about the same. And ahead of the curve. Good. Oh, two brave souls. Okay, good. So okay. We have not really gotten to a point there, and that's a major... Yeah.
Very good. Yeah, you know, and one of the challenges, just in my thinking about this, is there's so many of these, you know, new age technologies coming, robotics and autonomous trucks, besides the list we see up here. And Fab, you've been in the software business for a long time.
Long time.
JDA has this thing called the JDA Labs. It's looking at all kinds of, you and I were briefly talking about that before the session here, but I've got to see some of it, or not see it, but to talk to some of the leaders up there. You're looking at things like smart glasses, is just among many things. This panoply of... new technologies out here, which ones do you think are going to have an impact?
Well, that's a big question, and this whole topic is a big one. And you're right, I can't see the slide, but I did look at it. So, you know, the interesting thing when I looked at that graphic the other day is that there's a lot of things on that list that are very related to one another. They're not mutually exclusive. So you talk about supply chain visibility is one of the, you know, the number one thing, but that's a big umbrella of capability that will encompass many other sub-technologies as a part of it. So things like Internet of Things, just the whole pervasiveness of data is a big technological change, which is going to continue to grow. I think the real trick, though, in, you know, where companies like ours are investing is data is not an issue. Information is not an issue. It's how do you take that and actually do something tangible with it, right? And that was always, you know, I have been in this industry a long time, and during that time I've had many soapboxes that I've stood on, and one of them is around that number one topic, which is supply chain visibility. And my big kind of contention with that concept is everyone wants to see things, but the real value is in, well, once you see it, what do you do about it? What's the decision support? What's the intelligence that goes into that to be able to do something that's actionable? And I think that's where, when you look at all the emerging technologies, that's what it needs to converge to. So the ability to capture, you know, large amounts of data, to do advanced analytics, that's all got to tie into an ability for the solutions to enable the users to, not only for them to make intelligent decisions, but really present those intelligent decisions to them. Right now.
Yeah, Procter & Gamble has been talking about this notion of actionable visibility for 15 years or something now, so I think you're spot on there, although, you know, I've always talked about visibility as being sort of like an onion. You get one level, and then you pull a layer off, and then there's another level, and there's another level. And so it's kind of a journey, not a destination, I guess is maybe the easiest way to say it. Mike, obviously, your company's very involved in technology, particularly in the distribution side of things. Which of these coming technologies, and we can throw robots and other things in there, what do you see is going to have the biggest impact?
Sure. And certainly, you know, I'm compelled to talk about things you screw to the floor in the warehouse because that's what we do. If we contain it, we can sell it. But the majority of what we're doing and the majority of where we're investing our R&D right now is on the software side. And it's exactly what he said. And if I can step back, if you look at some of the terminology up there, if I ask three people in this room to describe the Internet of Things or analytics or big data, I get three different answers. They overlap and they'd fundamentally be the same. I think it goes back to our very first topic, which was labor and the absence of qualified labor, availability, retention. And all those technologies, one way or another, are all about productivity, about draining just a little bit more repeatability, productivity, GDP out of the remaining people you have to have working in your warehouse. Same goes for white collar. So to answer the question, finally, I think that certainly the visibility piece, we call it analytics, is the future of our organization. Everybody's figured out how to do three-axis motion with machines, and that's never going to go away, and there's opportunities. Robotics is a great one. Been doing robotics since the 80s, but vision and end effectors are what the throttle is in that, and it's boundless. It's boundless, and it's going to solve a subset of the first problem we talked about, which is labor. That aside, the accumulation of big data and the accumulation of predictive analytics, I'd like to say that we're in a predictive analytics mode in this industry. At best, we're doing great reporting. We're giving people phenomenal data to make wonderful decisions to increase productivity. But it's real-time kind of stuff, unless you disagree. I don't think we're at the predictive point yet where, based on the weather patterns and based on the fact that Christmas is coming, here's how I should slot my warehouse. We're not there yet. But we're getting there. And that, for the two souls that raise their hands saying that we're going to be in parallel coming up in a couple of years, that's what's going to get us there, is the predictive piece in the software, the ability to digest all the information that we're amassing and make phenomenal decisions based on what's going to happen versus what's happening. And that's going to solve a pretty good subset of that labor problem.
Okay, excellent. Bill, your thoughts on these many technologies and which, if any of them, are going to be the winners? Or all of them are going to be the winners?
Since we're in election season, you will give me the latitude to answer the question I want to answer rather than the one that was asked.
That's called staying on message.
And so please don't strain a muscle trying to convert what I'm saying to relate to anything that has been said previously. I think that when I get in an audience like this, I genuinely love the conversation because most of my life lives at a different horizon, a little further out, looking at things a little differently. You folks have to solve lots and lots of things immediately to stay in business. And I'll tell you, from the companies I work with, you do this magnificently. If you ask yourself, for example, suppose we're having this conversation 5 years from now, MHI annual meeting 2021, and we have Dan up here doing a workforce thing. What are the questions he's going to be asking then? I think that's we can spend rest of the day on that. Just something to think about. And I think about technology in a similar vein. Put technology as hardware. Talk about it in terms of software and analytics. There's some big things going on out there that are going to help and hurt depending on how you adopt. And not everybody adopts at the same speed. But there are technologies out there that are going to help within the four walls dramatically. Mike mentioned making decisions, and Fab mentioned making decisions. There's a kernel of that, I think, that has to do with how we make decisions. We've gone for years trying to push decisions to more distributed areas. We take information, we get it to a machine, we do things with it, we get it to small areas where you can make a decision, we present it so you can look at it. In 5 years, maybe we will have the ability to move that to a more centralized facility and let algorithms make many of these decisions. Maybe not driverless trucks that don't have, but think about your supply chain or what you do or what's important to you and the ability to coalesce this data and make a centralized decision in real time. It's got some tremendous potential. There's hardware out there now that can do some order picking. Surely that's going to be a winner, right? Everybody in here likely within the last week has ordered something online. It's equally likely you have not ordered a pallet's worth. Okay? Let's face it. It is possible that some of you from bigger cities ordered it and expected it to be there in 2 hours, right? If you're from New York, Chicago, San Francisco, think about that. At the Ontario meeting with the roadmap, they had a couple of real estate folks there, and one person was especially proud of, he was a developer, especially proud of this warehouse. And they're selling warehouse space in the Inland Empire that's away from the port back to the east by the cubic foot. And that's not a mistake. Warehouse space by the cubic. Think about what technology's got to do to go vertical. But now think about delivering items within 2 hours because Fab needed shaving cream this morning and left it at home. It's a fantastic notion. It impacts the workforce. It impacts trucks. It impacts all of this stuff. Are there going to be winners? All of this is going to be winners. But there are some central, I think, long-term notions that are going to have to be developed, and your companies are going to embrace, and some of you are going to be able to embrace them quicker because it's going to be more directly impacted, going to impact you positively and much quicker. But how information flows, how you create decisionable information from just data. Does a human have to be in that loop, or can an algorithm control certain things? The answer is all of that can happen. So the answer is everything on there is going to occur at different rates. Some of these things up here, I'm going to shut up right now, some of these things are available today on different scales. Some of them scale differently, ladies and gentlemen. Some of them can scale pretty quickly and we can grab them, and some of them are going to scale in a very difficult way. I'll think about the trucks when you're talking about areas. That's something that's probably very hard to scale all across the world in all kinds of environments, but it's probably not hard to scale it in certain situations that some of you will be able to take advantage of. So from a roadmap viewpoint, when we look out, I think all of this technology is going to drive a fair amount of what's going on. Workforce is going to follow along. Transitions in workforce. I'm from South Carolina, so I got to see, and I've been there for a number of years, and so I got to see this transition from textiles into BMW manufacturing. It's not fast. It's not pretty. But those kinds of things are going to happen. This discussion about warehouse workers very well could go away. There will be other people in there. They're going to have to be trained differently. But this technology is going to dramatically change everything that, in my opinion, we discuss over the next 10 years.
Very good. Jonathan, from a FedEx perspective, I know you're looking at some of these advanced things. Which you know, do you see the most promise in, or where's the interest?
I don't think we know yet, to be honest with you. I wish I could say that X, Y, and Z are going to be the way of the future. We don't know. Not discounting anything, I think it would be silly to not investigate what the potential is, but I think today we really just don't know. There's some low-hanging fruit, to be sure, and there's some things out there, but there's also, you hear a lot about the autonomous driving vehicles. I mean, there's some really big, you know, really cool Star Trek ideas out there that you think, wow, that's going to be it. Well, but there's headwinds against that. There's, whether it's infrastructure or regulatory environment or, you know, the absence of certain technologies to employ that today, all that's standing in the way. We don't know. What's going to have the most, and maybe what we're talking about today isn't going to be tomorrow. It's going to be a derivative of the things that we're looking at today. There's an awful lot of things being worked on and being developed out there by some very smart companies that are producing solutions that we don't have a problem to apply them to yet. And it's going to take a little while to work that out. The engineer in me is completely geeked out by the potential. I love it.
Does FedEx have a, you know, idea lab type of setup somehow?
I wouldn't go so far as to call it a lab, but we have some very smart people looking at how things can be applied.
Okay, very good. Mike, anything to add on the technology side?
Yeah, I've got three brief points.
Okay.
I've been very involved with an organization, Young President's Organization, for a lot of years, and I was at a summit a couple weeks ago. And I heard a person give a talk that could have been given here about disruption, accelerating change. And her point was, when you're in the midst of the disruption, you have no idea about the magnitude of the disruption. So Dan knows this. I was in Iceland a couple weeks ago watching whales. And I noticed we were in this little boat, you know, close to the water so we could see the whales. And, you know, I was noticing we were kind of going up and down. And the person said, well, this is nothing. This is only 12 to 14 feet. Now, you know, 12 to 14 feet, kind of like, it's a big deal to me. But you're in the midst of this disruption. The second thing, I will tell you where I think we're going. One of the things with YPO, I was at a Manufacturing Excellence Network Summit. How many of you are in organizations that are emphasizing lean principles? Okay, almost everybody. What's one of the key principles of lean? Eliminating waste, right? We're at the Herman Miller facility in Zeeland, Michigan. Show of hands. Anyone have a guess on how long it takes for them to assemble their Aeron chair? I've done this a couple times. People said, anyone want to take a guess how long it takes them to assemble a chair? Anyone?
5 minutes.
5 minutes. 21 seconds.
Wow.
21 seconds, and they think they can do it faster. And so my point is that where we're going with the analytics and you know the data that you're talking about, from my perspective, I think, you know, there's a book that was written years ago by Peter Senge. It's called The Fifth Discipline. If you haven't read it, it's almost a business Bible because it talks about mental models and how we see things. And what I think is going to happen with analytics, Dan, and I'm seeing it already, you see chaos, but what JDA and others take and the software that's being written, you take a look and step back and you'll see patterns. When I see patterns, I can move to predictability. And I tell this one story about a customer. We're doing this analytics project for them. Their 85% of their transportation moves in the spot market. 85% moves in the spot market. Now, in a down market, that's good. In a bad, tight market, that's bad. Why are they 85%? Because their supply chain is just too chaotic. So what we did is we presented them with this thing and saying, you see it as chaotic, but your customers know exactly when they're going to be running their production lines. Your customers know stuff in advance, and when I start taking what they're doing, I can say with a 95% degree of probability that I will be moving freight on the second Tuesday or Wednesday of the month 95% of the time, because this is how this customer has operated over the last couple years. UPS, talking to them, you know, think about this from a capacity standpoint. According to their former president, one out of every five UPS trucks traveling down the highway travels empty. Think about the waste. So what UPS is talking about is how do we look at our network to eliminate waste, and I think that's where analytics, from our perspective, is going to drive a lot of things that we can't even begin to fathom today.
It's funny, that example you gave the trucking company, immediately what jumps to mind is the famous bullwhip effect in consumer goods or other sectors, where even though underlying demand is stable, the order patterns from the retailers are oscillating up and down. It seemed like actually kind of an example of that in the trucking industry. Just one quick comment on the Internet of Things, and no one's really brought that up. I've been a little bit of mixed opinion on this as well. There's no question there is an enormous amount of hype about Internet of Things. In fact, Gartner has their what they call famous technology hype cycles, and Internet of Things is right at the top of that hype cycle. And if you've ever seen it, what comes next is what they call the trough of disillusionment, where a lot of the bloom comes off the rose before eventually, I don't know what the next thing is, where things start to get better. But having said that, a couple of interesting things. You know, Caterpillar, for example, who's got like 5 million machines now connected out there and all over the globe. And one of the things that is of tremendous value to them is they're learning how their customers are actually using their product, okay? And so what it turns out is often their customers are using it very inefficiently. Okay, so you're a mining company in South Africa someplace, and you've got a Caterpillar truck, and you got a guy out there digging whatever he's doing. Well, you know, he could perhaps be 50% more efficient if he knew how to operate the equipment right, and Caterpillar can now tell that mining company, your people aren't using the equipment properly, okay? That's a big, giant, multi-million dollar Caterpillar piece of equipment. A piece out just the other day, we covered it in our weekly video news, just today. Smart guy from England, I'm not going to go into the details, but anyways, he's saying we're going to start to have sensors in something as simple as a mop. Why? He said because actually it turns out, and he did some research on this, people use mops in different ways across the globe. Okay, it's not a one-size-fits-all mop, even though that's what you get today. But it turns out, I think he used Indonesia and Thailand or something, I don't know. Turns out, actually, the mop design for Indonesia, because they go this way, maybe a little bit different than it is in Thailand, because they go, summarizing here. But that insight in terms of how customers are actually using our products, the consistent feedback is, I think this maybe even came out in the MHI trends report this year, not the roadmap, but what's the other report?
Annual report.
I think this actually was in the annual report with Deloitte. The insights into, you know, how it's like eye-opening, that you think you know all your customers are using your products, but it turns out you really don't. So I think there is a lot of hope in that. We're going to move on here quickly, but any audience comments on technology? Huge topic, obviously, but yes, sir.
So love the discussion. This is Nilesh Mohan from Target. Love the discussion about technology and workforce, and also about how technology is helping us with a workforce and having issues in the future. Our experience so far has been usually we're using technology to promote growth versus to really be able to either change for any of the labor issues and or the labor shortage. And one thing that we found with technology or automation is it creates a different issue around specifically niche expertise required, like maintenance or mechanics, or like you're talking about transportation. And I was wondering if there were any views about, as these technologies come in and as we use them, what are the different skill sets that would be required tomorrow, and what are we doing today about that?
I think it's a big issue. I don't know how to have a solution for it. Mike, go ahead. Yeah.
Sure. I think it's an excellent question. And coming from the automation sector, I think you hit a valid point. Contrary to the conversation we had earlier about should we have more folks encouraged maybe not to make that step into college, which I don't disagree with at all. I think that's a vital step. The world needs a balance of supply and demand and talent. But ownership, there's an ownership responsibility, and I come from the customer service part of our organization. There's an ownership responsibility that I think is becoming profound right now, where it used to be, I'm going to go buy a Ferrari, it's going to be fun to drive, and I'll take it in when something doesn't work. You have a fiduciary responsibility as an owner of technology, be it software or equipment, to both develop the paradigm that you're going to design it with and be part of a relationship during the design process, which has not been historical, but also from an aftermarket ownership standpoint, making an investment in understanding the technology, hiring the right people. So you're right. I just saw a statistic recently where, like, in Mexico, every job that's eliminated, 5 get created. In the U.S., it's 1 gets eliminated, 2 get created. I contend that the 2 that will be created will be of a higher caliber, higher knowledge level to accommodate that ownership responsibility. And looking at it differently, when you got that Ferrari, you owe it to that car and to the reputation of that industry to take it in for the checkups, to follow the owner's manual, to treat it differently. If I could take that one step further, I think another element of the discussion is that technology is going to be more granular than it ever was. Where Target may have built a giant $20 million automated DC many years ago and hope for the best, the acceleration of change in the marketplace due to e-commerce and a million other things has created the demand for more granular designs, more granular solutions. If you have any belief at all in yet another vague term, which is the Industry 4.0, I think right behind Industry 4.0 is Supply Chain 4.0, which has to follow with things like supply chain to accommodate micro-manufacturing. So back in the day when there might have been one big giant Pepsi bottling plant that employed thousands of people, there's now Acme bottling plant that bottles Coke, Pepsi, and Pabst Blue Ribbon all in the same plant and goes out different dock doors. More open systems, which is going to change the people working there, going to change the nature of those people working there, and also more trust. I think you brought this up. The exposure and trust level needs to be higher as well. So a bit off topic, but that all relates back to what it's going to take to own technology is changing over time.
Yeah, this notion of collaborative logistics or horizontal collaboration, which you're kind of alluding to there. If we get to it, we'll talk about that today, but I think it could be a big issue.
Can I just throw out one other point? I mean, I was talking to a friend of mine that works at Whirlpool, and I was asking him this summer about this Internet of Things. Wynn is his name. And I said, Wynn, is this hyped? And he said, Mike, let me tell you the impact that it's going to have. He said, what it's going to do for Whirlpool is transition our orientation from looking backward to looking forward. And so what they're going to be able to tell, because they're going to see the refrigerators we're selling today, here's the expected life cycles of the compressors, here's what we need to have for compressors 5 years out, 7 years out. And what his whole theme was, once again getting back to the issue of patterns, is it creates a level of predictability in our business so that if, assuming, you know, unlike a Samsung with the Galaxy 7, which is a hugely disruptive event, comes out of nowhere, normal patterns, we can predict what our business is going to look like 4, 5, 6, 7 years out. Interesting frame.
Fab, you got a comment?
Yeah, I think I'm going to actually tee off both commentaries. So one of the technology sets that's or technology themes that's emerging that's not on that list, that's an important one, is this notion of microservices. Hmm. And for lack of a just simple description of what that is, think about, you know, you buy a car and it, you know, comes with a whole bunch of stuff, but then you can go aftermarket and you can soup up that car, you can make it prettier or faster or whatever you want to do. And this is an important concept because for two reasons. One is software, you know, in the enterprise software world, we have lots of software that's existed for decades. That's difficult to replace, difficult to maintain, difficult to upgrade. And no one's really going to let, you know, it's difficult to let go of that technology. So one of the strategies that now is to create these microservices, almost think of it almost like apps, where you can kind of bolt them on. Where you can take what you already have, what you've already invested in, and improve it and make it different by plugging in some, you know, some external capability. And it could be, you know, another partner that you're leveraging, or something that, you know, your software provider's building natively. And that's it's this ability now to create these smaller solutions that are easier to deploy, that focus on either enabling a very specific capability, right, or solving a very specific problem. And that's something that we're seeing a lot of.
Yeah. Which can help in taming the issue of kind of software bloat, right, where you're trying to do everything for everybody in the core package or whatever, and so you just have this increasingly, gigundous application. Maybe I can solve it by going through some services. So, Absolutely. Okay, we're going to keep moving on because we're running out of time. I want to get to a little bit more here. Next topic is consumer, and, I, as big as we all understand e-commerce is, I think we actually underappreciate what's actually going on here. We are in the point of turning the traditional consumer goods to retail and even B2B markets upside down by what's happening. This is the Economic Department has an e-commerce growth every quarter. I think the last one that came out is Q2. I mean, it's 15% quarter after quarter after quarter. That's doubling every 5 years, maybe a little bit less, about 4.5 years is going to double. Think of the impact on that. It's monumental. We track, Supply Chain Digest tracks e-commerce sales as a percent of total retail. The government gives you one number, which I think right now is somewhere around 7.5%, somewhere along those lines. But that includes all kinds of stuff that has nothing to do with e-commerce. So, for example, in that retail sales number is restaurants and bars. Okay, we yank that out. Okay, we yank out fuel distributors, so we don't think that's a, you know, so there's all these things that go into the overall retail number that aren't what we would kind of consider traditional retail. If you take all those things out, in 2015, we were at 11% of total retail sales were coming from e-commerce and rising incredibly rapidly, as you can see. This is going to have an enormous impact, already having an enormous impact. Have you been following, what's been one of the key kind of trends going on in all of 2015? Retailers shutting down stores. Right, Macy's, American Apparel, Sports Authority went out of business. You know, there was a whole slew of them, JCPenney, I forget. There's a whole slew of them, Sears and Kmart. Many others have shut down many stores. Okay, and so as the retail space contracts and constricts to deal with e-commerce, Walmart just announced a couple weeks ago, 2017, they're only going to build 55 new U.S. stores, 35 supercenters, 20 marketplaces. Maybe I have that back and forth. That's not from hundreds in a typical year, right? Where's the $11 billion they're going to spend on CapEx going? Most of it into e-fulfillment DCs, okay? This is going to have a mind-boggling impact because as retail supply chains change, then consumer goods industry supply chains that are set up to serve the retail are going to have to change in kind, right? So this is I think as much as we understand it, I don't think we fully understand the implication this is going to have for our supply chains for almost everybody. And it's not just B2C, although that's a big part of it. B2B, you talk about Grainger, for example. Grainger, when they had their sales guys out there and doing whatever, they kind of had a consistent order flow throughout the day. When e-commerce came along and they really invested there, what they found is that their supervisors on the shop floor would all do their first shift stuff until about 2 o'clock. Then at 2 o'clock, they would finally get around to ordering what they needed for the next day from Grainger. Okay, it used to be a smoother flow. Well, guess what? If I don't know what it is, but if you order in by 3, it's out the guarantee the next day or whatever it is. So all of a sudden now they had this surge of orders that were coming in mid-afternoon that all were committed that have to go out that same day. Okay, it's like a peak season, you know, peak hour, in, you know, that you, no one had really experienced before. So this is a big, big topic. I'd like to hear, Gary, maybe just real quickly some of the input from the conclaves.
Okay, great. The first point actually goes to fab shaving cream problem.
And by the way, I did forget
I had a good
It's predictive analytics. We knew that ahead of time.
There's a pattern. This is great because I'm going to come back to predictive analytics in a few seconds. So the first point they made was the tyranny of now is not going to be any less important 10 years from now. The other part, the point that they made was that innovations that are coming in today are the new baseline. And I'll give you a perfect example of it. 5 years ago, my daughter was a high school math teacher. She must have taken somebody's phone one day or whatever, and there became a discussion about the internet. And she told them that when she first started to use the web, she used this thing called dial-up. And you know what they said to her? You're lying. It never worked that way. Okay, so how quickly do we forget? Think about pull, not push. There's a whole new world of return logistics that's coming in here. We're going to have to take pay attention to that in ways that we haven't in the past. Going to the predictive analytics, being able to anticipate consumer demand and behavior is going to become increasingly important because people generally think that forecasting today just doesn't work anymore. Much more personalization, some call it mass customization. Much greater responsiveness to products and time. And in fact, people are going to have to start to decide what is the value of time in the supply chain. I think we're just at the early stages of that. There's also a thought out there that the supply chain is going to have to start to manage the expectations of consumers. There's some dismay that they don't understand how the supply chain works. Well, I think of the ads Intel Inside. I don't really care how it works, it just does. But there's something that we're going to have to work through there. And finally, we ask the question, will the supply chain have to be built, rebuilt from the consumer backwards? Mm-hmm. And the answer so far is it's going to depend upon the individual company.
Very good. So this is a huge topic. I'm going to give you one quick example on if I can get this right. Home Depot, who you know is doing a tremendous amount of e-commerce business now, has these, I think, three e-commerce DCs set up across the country, and they carry a bazillion SKUs, millions, I don't know what it's, some humongous number. Okay. Well, they also have a service where customers order online to pick up in store. So the question is, how do I get that product from my three e-commerce DCs to that store? Well, what they were doing is shipping either parcel or LTL into those stores at tremendous cost. Greatly simplifying, what they have a program now is doing, they have enough volume, and it doesn't even have to be a full truck, it's still cheaper. Even a half a truck is good enough, where they pick all the product for a given region of stores, truckloads ship that freight into the normal Home Depot distribution center that serves those stores, then they have a whole cross-dock program about how they do this, and then they ship it a short delivery with the regular store delivery, into that store fulfillment, saving some significant amount of transportation costs. So, I mean, this is really creative kind of thinking out there. Others may be doing something similar, but this is the kind of changes we're seeing in terms of overall supply chains. Jonathan, obviously, FedEx is investing billions in the network, and I don't even know where to begin to ask you to comment on this. Other, what is e-commerce and consumer, doing to your business? How are you responding?
Well, e-commerce really is kind of standing the industry on its ear right now. There's an expectation for services that wasn't there very long ago. That it's I want it here, I want it there, I want it now. I mean, there's a whole lot of stuff that is changing. What that's going to mean is that eventually the supply chain to deal with that is going to be radically different than what we're accustomed to. I mean, already some companies that are out there are really pushing the envelope in how they're setting things up. Is the large distribution center really what the wave of the future is? Maybe not. I mean, there's a trend towards urbanization. We've talked about that in many different sessions. So we're talking smaller distribution centers in urban markets, which means vertical space. That changes the technology that's inside the building. The workforce issue changes the number of people who are inside the building. So really, I like the idea of building the supply chain from the consumer backwards, because that's exactly what needs to happen, and it's going to change everything from soup to nuts.
Yeah, very good. Mike, go back to you here real quick. In terms of four-wall sort of DC design, I mean, what are the trends you're seeing in support of e-commerce? What are companies doing now? Are they running one facility just to handle e-commerce? Is it still a blend in retail of store fulfillment and e-commerce support? And from a technology perspective, I know that's a big question. You know, what are people, you know, where's the investment going?
Sure. And it depends entirely on the industry. We've got Home Depot, we got Target. There are a lot of companies happily moving along the Nordstroms of the world with parking lots full of cars on a Saturday. Home Depot no different. And then you have a company like Amazon, who's unfortunately not very profitable, setting the bar. So you got this company that's maybe more focused on growth than on profit, for whatever duration that may be, setting the expectations of the customer. And back to your point, and the customer, once they get expectations set by a giant like Amazon, once you have free shipping, you want free shipping. Once you see one day, you want one day. So all these other companies have to adjust accordingly and jump through hoops to accommodate what a low-profit organization is determining to be the norm. So, from a tactical standpoint, in the warehouse, you've got folks, high-end retailers, I'm making up a name, say Nordstrom's, that is sticking their toe in the water and would say, well, we're not ready yet to go pure play. We're not going to shut down. Our whole charm is $300 shirts hanging nicely ironed on racks. That's what we do. But we have to get in the business. So folks like that may alter the way they adopt technology. They may very well likely impart supply chain technology for e-commerce in an existing facility. Maybe they'll 3PL it. They'll start in that regard. So those I'll call the slow adopters. In the middle, you got folks that say, we're going in, and we're going to build e-commerce centers to accommodate this new sub-market. And those folks, when that was tried in the dot-com era, failed because we were building giant new distribution centers on top of existing distribution centers when the population wasn't growing that fast. So you do the math and you say, I don't have that many people to receive all this stuff, so something's got to give, and that was part of the bust. They're doing it more strategically now, more surgically, where we're building distribution centers, clearly smaller orders, more regional, smaller facilities. I won't go as far as to say micro yet, but ones that are highly flexible, focused on direct-to-consumer. When the world switched from e-commerce to omni-channel, that opened up a whole other set of information challenges, which I'm sure you're well aware of, where an order goes into this amoeba of an enterprise and may go to the store to be fulfilled, maybe may go to the brick-and-mortar DC to be fulfilled, or may go to the e-commerce, depending on, in that second of time, where's the best place to fulfill this order. So there's a huge software component to the answer, but from a technology standpoint, small shuttle systems that handle goods to person, back to the issue of labor, because you can't find qualified labor, and nobody wants to get the wrong package on their doorstep. It's intolerable. So it has to be 100% accurate fulfillment. So good for us, a lot of automation, a lot of goods to person, a lot of voice, a lot of pick-to-light, things that are damn near foolproof, frankly, but not pallet handling, not big, giant, 100-foot-tall DCs.
Bill, what are you seeing in terms of the impact e-commerce, the consumer centricity that we seem to be moving to, impact on supply chain?
I think it's going to drive much of exactly what these men have said. It's going to drive much of what you do. The urbanization, in my opinion, can't be ignored. You're competing. We used to compete on lots of things, quality. Now it's really on cycle time, and I wasn't kidding. You're right. It's next day, but I had a friend of mine that's at Berkeley that was watching a basketball game, I don't know, with his kid, and his wife needed paper, and he had this coupon that was for 2 hours. And so rather than get up and go get the paper, he app, go, and somebody showed up for 2 hours. So we can't divorce that. And it's there. And so he didn't have to not watch the basketball game to get the ream of paper for his wife to continue working. So it's the demand's growing. Conceptually, I think many of us like me, still think of moving things, a unit load, as a pallet. And that's just not true anymore. And it's getting smaller every single day. So in 10 years, whatever our concept is of a unit load is going to be getting smaller. And the delivery time is where we're going to be competing, so it's going to be getting faster. And these folks are going to be bringing as much stuff back as they are sending out. You mentioned things that Amazon was doing. How many of you have ordered something from folks that are set up to have it come back? Right there, there are companies out there right now that send people, if they 4 or 5 pairs of shoes, in the knowing the idea is to send 4 of them back. So it's not that it's predictable, it's there. And so think about that. If everybody decides that everything that goes out comes back, and we're getting urban, and we're getting dense, and we've got to go vertical, but and we've got to do this in 2 hours, by the way, or the next company that says 1 hour and 15 minutes or 1 hour and 30 minutes. I'm sorry, I'm kind of going at this by saying that this is going to drive the winners and losers. And I think it's cycle time, it's automation to fulfill the orders, and then somehow we've got to get the stuff back. And then, oh, by the way, I would suspect that most of you out there right now have more data than you and Fab can handle. So let's multiply that by, what, 10, 100, square it, cube it. And now we've got to take that and use it to get information on how we're moving things. So I think it's going to drive innovations that are small daily to compete, and it's going to drive bigger innovations that are will move your industry forward.
Fab, from a software perspective, and I've known you, worked with you a long time, know JDH's product very well. You know, you're coming at this from numerous angles. You've got the warehouse management, you've got the transportation, the routing, the scheduling, you've got the network design, right? All of these come into play. So what are you seeing as the impact? Where is this headed to the extent we can answer that? And then, is it really all about the last mile? Is that where the locus of attention really needs to be?
Okay, so much to answer.
Yeah.
That last mile one.
You have 3 minutes.
I'll save that because I'm going to have to that one. Just listening to my peers here, there's just so much to talk about. And quite honestly, as a guy who came out of the transportation space, you know, when you talk about trends in transportation the last 20 years, you talk about, you know, fuel and capacity and trucks and stuff. It's, you know, it ebbs and flows, but it's always the same stuff. So this whole notion of consumer centricity has actually been quite exciting from a supply chain perspective. It's interesting. A couple of comments and just tee off from my peers here. First of all, there's no one size fits all. That's the one thing we have to understand, is that there's no silver bullet to solve the problem. There's things that we just mentioned that are characteristics that have to be solved for, but you can't assume that what's going to work for a Home Depot is going to work for a Target or work for anyone else. You're going to have different assets, you're going to have different products that you're moving. Right, do-it-yourself is very different than fast fashion, right? So you can't assume that, you know, one set of network flows is going to work. The one commentary I want to tee off that's really important, I think, is, and I think companies are getting it, but it's almost two concepts. One is, you can't think about just solving the e-commerce problem. You have a supply chain problem. Right, that's what you have to solve. And I think when companies, the one thing we saw specific here in North America, more so than in other places like Europe, is the first inclination is to silo it. Right, I'm going to have an e-commerce strategy that's different than all my other stuff. And the problem is, as soon as you do that, you lose your scale. Right, which is the second part of the problem. And I had one customer that framed this quite well. You have this problem now where you have to, your supply chains are built for scale, right? They're built to move pallets and trucks. But now you have to service each's. But you can't service each's and ignore the scale, because then you're not going to make money. And you know, the Amazon comment here is interesting, and I think all of us have lived through the dot-com era. We're all of that age. My contention is that eventually money has to be made. Right, and those of us that, you know, if you work for a public company, you know eventually that those chickens are going to come home to roost. Anyway, that's a different topic. But to extend that concept, then, is the other part that's very important. And I think the leaders that I see in industry that are looking at tackling this well
it starts and ends with the customer. So they are replanning their supply chains from not just the customer perspective, but that intersection between customer and product, or product grouping, right? Because that combination, and working backwards from that, is impactful. It's not just about that individual consumer. That's an important part of it. But what is it that they're buying? And again, we're going to pick on Home Depot because you mentioned them and they're right here. I can see their hands. Right? The consumer that's going to buy, you know, nails, right, needs nuts, bolts, nails, those fast-moving products is very different than the one that's going to buy a shed or a lawnmower. So how do you, you know, it's not the same e-commerce solution to those two problems. So those things have to come together. Last mile. And this relates kind of to the diatribe I just went through. You know, we have a tendency in this industry, and I'm not just talking from a technology perspective, although we're very guilty of this. We latch on to buzzwords. We latch on to these crazy trends. We make that a topic. It's news. We go crazy about it. But we don't necessarily think about where it applies, what's the real importance of it. And last mile is very, very, very critical, clearly. Especially when you get into you know, particularly maybe this is more so here in the U.S. than in where I am in Canada, but this, you know, ability to turn around products very, very quickly. But we can't look at that. I guess the key point I want to drive from a technology perspective is you can't look at that at the exclusion of everything else. And one of the big things that we're looking at is a big driver in what I'm responsible for is this whole convergence between planning and execution. In most organizations, those are very siloed functions. I have people that look at my forecast, and I look at people that replenish and push inventory out, and I have my warehouse people, and I have my transportation people. That all has to come together.
Yeah. Right? If you look at the, you know, sort of textbook, you know, hierarchical supply chain planning models, right? There's no execution even on the diagram, right? It's strategic, operational, tactical, and then it just assumed execution happens. So there's obviously a disconnect there from the get-go.
They all have to tie together. And one last point I'll throw out there. You know, a lot of times when we talk about, you know, different trends and strategies, you know, for example, to combat Amazon, we'll often talk about, well, you need to leverage your store to get closer to consumer. That's your asset, right? That's, you're already in a position if you're a traditional brick-and-mortar retailer to get closer to the consumer. But it's not so simple, right? Your store can't just become a DC overnight. Where are you going to put the inventory? Do you have the right labor, right, to pick, pack, and ship all of a sudden? We spell labor properly up north, by the way. I don't know what it is for you Americans and you. But, you know, it's not such a simple... And then the whole idea of visibility, right? Visibility inventory. And I always tell this one story where, and I'm guilty of this, you know, I went to reserve something online for... I reserved a game for my sons at, you know, big electronics retailer of your choice. And I went to go pick it up. I hadn't paid for it yet. I just reserved it. Went to go pick it up. Saw that their line, which was dedicated for guys like me, was too long. And I'm a typical northerner. I'm a little hyper, and I have very little patience. And so I went to the shelf and found it. And went and paid for it and got out the door. Faster than the person who would have been ahead of me got to the front. And think about the inventory challenge that now presents. Right? Because there was inventory committed. So, I mean, these are all things that, from a technology perspective, it's very exciting that we're looking to solve.
Okay, very good. We are very short on time.
I got to do one last night.
I'm going to cut you off, okay, because we have 5 minutes, and I'm going to get through infrastructure come hell or high water.
thank you.
Okay, we only got about 5 minutes. I'm going to do this real quick, and I want to get Mike's opinion. So this is the famous American Society of Civil Engineers. This is their last report card for U.S. infrastructure, 2013. As you can see, C's, D's all across the board. With solid waste, I guess we're a B minus. So this is one perspective on infrastructure, right? It's this constant gloomy, you know, U.S. infrastructure is falling apart, or roads and bridges are, you know, collapsing, all of that stuff. That's one view, right? Is that right? I don't know. If you look at the World Bank Logistics Performance Index that comes out every other year, it's a very, very interesting report. This one that came out just in 2016. In terms of logistics infrastructure, the World Bank, and they have all these freight forwarders that fill out surveys all across the globe, actually we rated 8th in the entire world for logistics infrastructure. Okay, so which is right? I don't know. Okay, I think it's a little of both. Gary, we just got a couple minutes. I'm going to go straight to Mike because I want his thoughts. Your thoughts on logistics infrastructure, good, bad, in the middle.
So I just want to, and I appreciate you allowing me to say this. this has been one of the most fascinating panel discussions I've ever been part of, and my question that I've got for you is, what is the practical take-home value? When you leave Tucson, go back to your office, what's going to change? Hopefully, one thing you're going to change is to let your CEO, if you're the CEO, then take heart. If you're not, get to your CEO, whoever. Let them know that our infrastructure, we are basically living off of an investment that was made in the 1950s. We are living off Dwight Eisenhower's Interstate Highway. Just to give you a little heads up about why this is so important, last week, the American Trucking Association is predicting 2016 to 2027, we're going to see freight on the roads increase by 35%. Folks, where is that going to go? Cost-wise, it's a disaster. We're talking a couple of hundred billion. What compounds it is every common sense solution to eliminate waste, to maximize the value of our infrastructure is fought. Dan knows this. I've been one of the ones really involved in increasing trucks from 80 to 97,000 pounds. We save about $25 billion. The railroad's dead on arrival. There's a proposal that's going to be re-upped to get twin 33s. Cost savings to the industry. FedEx is way behind it. Old Dominion and others. About $30 billion. Should be a proverbial no-brainer. We've got truckload carriers like Swift and Knight fighting it. It's a mess, and it's only going to get worse. My hope is, just summed up, I was in Chicago at a meeting where a very prominent individual that owns a very, you know, mega company was telling me in Chicago the CEOs are getting together. Top priority for the CEOs of these Chicago-based companies is infrastructure. The Civic Committee of Chicago is putting infrastructure as their number one agenda item for their interactions with our senator and congressman. And the good news is, both presidents have said they're in favor of a substantial infrastructure. But to give you one final idea, Dan, we are investing, the last highway bill that came out is basically about 20% of what we need to have a competitive infrastructure, because that eighth, you know, number eight, we are morphing into third world status, folks. And so you want e-commerce, you want this, you want a supply chain, you want all these things to happen. It takes a substantial and efficient infrastructure. I'll get off my high horse.
Okay, so I'm going to end this with one thing. This is actually, Mike, I don't know if you've seen this. This is a chart I actually made a few years ago based on comments you made at NASTRAC, I think 4 years ago. And that is that there is going to be a cost to improving that infrastructure, right? Higher diesel taxes. There's notions in Washington of charging the trucking industry for like the social costs of driving, which could jump. So there is going to be some cost. And early on, let's just say, in terms of reducing congestion in major metro markets or whatever, there's going to be a benefit to the supply chain and the transportation industry from doing that. But at some point, those benefits might level off as the cost starts going up. And now, from a just purely supply chain perspective, there may be other perspectives or stakeholders here, but now all of a sudden those costs start to rise above what the benefits to the industry is. I have no idea what that point is, but I think it's a very important one to think about. And Mike has been very vociferous about getting involved with your legislators and pushing some of these initiatives that he talked about here. I don't know what the answer to that is, but something to just kind of keep in mind that I think as a supply chain industry as a whole, we need to get a better handle on where that point is and how far do the investments make good economic sense, and then if it got out of hand, do they start to make not good economic sense? So I think with that, we're going to have to wrap it up. I want to give a big hand for our panel here, if you would. Talk about this, but there is a lab. Who wants to talk about it? A lab session connected with this that happens at 2:30 today, I believe it is.
2 o'clock.
Okay.
2:30.
And what's going to happen there is we're going to go ahead.
It's actually a workshop. We're going to ask you to sit down and talk about consumer workforce technology. Each table will talk about just one topic. What is going on today in your company? How are you dealing with it? How do you think it's going to change? And what are you going to have to do in the next 3, 5, 10 years? One other last point. You all have on your seats surveys. Please complete them and hand them in on your way out. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, everybody.
Yeah. Great job. Good, yes, that'll work out well.